the afternoon session. I'm taking the mean of these two clocks, or something like that, to be our official clock, some harmonic mean. So our first speaker is Ryan O'Donnell, who will be talking about Fourier entropy and the influence conjecture.
Thanks, Madhu. Thanks for inviting me to the organizers. Yeah, so this is a problem that Gil alluded to in his talk, and I worked on it for a while, a long time ago, and got nothing. And then I worked on it again last semester with my students.
And got something.
John Wright and Yuan Zhou, and we got something. So yeah, I guess the conclusion is I need some help. I don't know if this is kind of unfair to my co-authors, but the results I'm going to tell you about today, it's like not the most amazing stuff in the world. I mean, we got something, but I think this talk should be more of a... Sorry.
Oh.
Sure.
Is that on now?
Is the red light on?
It is?
Is it? Apple.
Okay, anyway.
Recording.
Good. Okay. Yeah, so you should
take this, I think you should take this talk as more of an advertisement for the problem than
an advertisement for the results that I actually present. Okay, so this talk is about Boolean functions, which I will write like this. I'll represent bits as minus 1 and 1, because it'll be convenient to think of the Fourier expansion as just a multilinear real polynomial. So the Fourier expansion here is just that f of x, this represents a vector of n plus or minus 1s, is the sum over all subsets of the coordinates 1 through n of the Fourier coefficient f hat s, is the real number, times the monomial corresponding to s. Okay. If I ever start using some notation that you don't know what it is, just please stop me and ask. Okay, so by Parseval, we know that the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients is equal to the expected value under the uniform distribution of f squared. If it's Boolean value, then f squared is always 1. So of course, we have the property that sum over all Fourier coefficients s is the Fourier coefficient squared is equal to 1. Okay, that's nice. So because we have a bunch of non-negative numbers that add up to 1, so you can think of them as a probability distribution. And indeed, let's make a definition for that. There's an associated random variable that takes on values which are subsets of n, and this is sometimes called the spectral sample. Okay, so I'll write it as script s, although it really depends on f, so I should probably write script s sub f. But it's the sort of set-valued random variable which has, these probabilities. So the probability that this script s equals a fixed set s is the squared Fourier coefficient. Okay, so once I've given you that definition, I can now state the conjecture, which is due to Gill and Ehud from 96. And it's a nice conjecture because I can say it with very few symbols. It's just that for all f, we have... the entropy of this random variable is at most a universal constant times the expectation of the cardinality. Okay, so this is Shannon entropy, and this is a universal constant. So first, what is the intuition or meaning of this statement? Well, it's a bit hard to say, but one thing you can sort of say is that the entropy of this random variable f kind of somehow measures how spread around the Fourier weights, the squared Fourier coefficients, are. And so it's saying that if you have a Boolean function and the weight is somehow very spread around, so the left-hand side is big, then the right-hand side must be big, meaning that somehow it must be up high. I mean, it must be on sort of large coefficients, large sets.
So is either the left-hand side or the right-hand side well understood?
The right-hand side is very well understood. I'll give a combinatorial interpretation of it in a second. It's just the total influence. The left-hand side is kind of, it is what it is. I mean, it's some function of the Fourier coefficients. I should also mention that this is certainly, this inequality is certainly false if you merely have that the expected square of f is 1. So, I mean, it's really about Boolean-valued functions. Okay, so let me just, state the exact same thing, but I'll put in the Fourier formulas. So the left-hand side here is sum over S, F hat, S squared, times log base 2, 1 over F hat, S squared. And the right-hand side is sum over S, F hat, S squared, times the cardinality of S. And so you may recognize the right-hand side as, we call this star. This is a formula for this thing that's called the total influence, which we essentially saw in Gill's talk. Although we're only going to think about, in reference to his talk, the P equals 1 half case, the uniform distribution case. So star is called the total influence. It has many other names too, like average sensitivity, sort of also the size of the edge boundary of F, if you think of F as the indicator of a subset of the Boolean cube. So I'll talk about its combinatorial interpretation in a second. Any questions so far? Okay. So I can tell you a little bit more about this as a combinatorial interpretation in terms of F. Let me remind you about a basic operator that we'll need for this discussion, which is the discrete derivative. Okay, so for each coordinate 1 through n, I, there's an operator, di, the discrete derivative, which acts on actually any real-valued function f. And it acts in the following way. Di f of x is f of x. I'm just going to invent some notation now that I hope will be clear, where you change the ith coordinate of x to 1 minus f of x, where you change the ith coordinate to minus 1 over 2. As I said, this is well defined for any real-valued functions f. And I would like to make a bunch of observations about this discrete derivative if you haven't seen it before. The first one is that dIf, this is a function on n variables, but it actually doesn't depend on the ith variable. Because you see, it doesn't really matter what the ith coordinate of x is, because you're just going to change it to 1 and change it to minus 1 and do this little calculation. Nevertheless, it's convenient to think of f as still being defined on all n variables, even though one of them is sort of actually irrelevant. What else do I want to say? If f is a Boolean valued function of the kind we mainly care about here, so if its range is minus 1, 1, then, of course, the derivative's range is minus 1, 0, 1. Okay, that's clear from the formula. And in particular, now we can start to see some combinatorial meaning. In this case, you see di f of x equals 0 if and only if sort of f is insensitive to the ith coordinate on input x. Okay, so if x is an input for f where flipping the ith coordinate doesn't really matter to the output of f, then this thing is 0. Otherwise, it's, plus or minus 1. What else should I say? Okay, another nice property that's extremely easy to check is that this discrete derivative operator really just acts formally as the derivative. So if you have the representation of f as a multivariate polynomial and you want to know a multilinear polynomial and you want to know the representation for the discrete derivative, you just take the derivative. Okay, so in other words, dIf of x is equal to the sum, let me say overall, s, which contain I of f hat s, because the other ones go to 0 when you take the derivative. And then you have the monomial, let's say, product over j in s minus I xj. Okay, that's very easy to check. And so now what happens if we apply Parseval's relation to this identity? In other words, the sum of the squares of the coefficients of this, the Fourier coefficients of this guy is equal to the expected square of the function. Well, what you see then, the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients is just the sum over all sets S that contain I of F hat S squared. And we know that equals the expectation over a uniform X of di fx, squared. Okay, let me assume now that I'm considering only minus 1, 1 valued functions f, Boolean functions f. Then by this observation, I mean this square of the derivative will be 1 if the ith coordinate is sort of relevant for f on x, and 0 if it's irrelevant. So this is nothing more than the probability over x that f of x with the ith coordinate set to 1 differs from f of x with the ith coordinate set to minus 1. And this is nice because, I mean, it's sort of a combinatorial interpretation of this Fourier theoretic quantity. And in particular, this is what, we saw from Gill's talk is called the influence of the ith coordinate on f. So in particular, there's another quantity also introduced by Gill, the total influence of f, which is, I'll denote capital I of f, which is just defined to be the sum of these influences, sum over I from 1 to n of the ith influence. Okay. And now let's plug in the Fourier formula for the ith influence that we have here. I got sum over I, sum over s containing I, f hat s squared. So of course, whenever we see a double sum, we would like to reverse it. So we have sum over s, f hat s squared. And how many times for a given set s does it get counted in this formula? It gets counted once for each of its elements. So it gets counted cardinality of s times. OK, so you see, finally, this is exactly this quantity star. OK, so the right-hand side of this quantity in the Fourier entropy influence conjecture has a nice combinatorial interpretation, average sensitivity or edge boundary or total influence of f.
Do you have a belief as to which f is extreme for this?
For this inequality? No, I'll talk about that in a second. OK. Right. Let me introduce one more piece of notation that I'll use during the talk.
Oded wants to know whether it's known for symmetric functions.
You'll find out, Oded. You'll find out soon. I'll say the weight at level k of a function f, which I denote like this, w sub k of f, is just the sum of the squares of the Fourier coefficients of cardinality k. Okay, so I don't have anything more to say about that for now, but some notation we'll need. OK, so now that I've sort of told you about some parts of the inequality, let's step back for a second and talk a little about history and make some remarks about this Fourier entropy influence conjecture. So as I said, it was made by Ehud Friedgut and Gil Kalai in 96. And I think their original motivation was the one that was talked about by Gil this morning, sort of the studying threshold phenomena for Boolean functions. And in particular, this is the total influence, as we saw. It's basically the same thing as the derivative of mu p of f with respect to p at p equals a half in Gill's notation. So if this thing is large, it means the function, if f is monotone at least, has a sort of sharp threshold. Okay, and they're interested in finding general conditions on a function f which would make it large. And if this conjecture was held, then you could say if the Fourier spectrum is sort of spread around, then that forces the total influence to be large. So concretely, in terms of applications, I'm not sure if there's maybe a direct application of this viewpoint to some unknown problem. But the conjecture has some other implications, too, which are nice. One easy consequence of the conjecture is, a weak form of another conjecture called Mansour's conjecture, made by Yishai Mansour in 94. Which briefly says that if you have a function represented by a polynomial size DNF formula, then most of its Fourier coefficients are concentrated on a collection of polynomially many coefficients. And this in turn actually implies some results in learning theory. This is Mansur's conjecture, some work of Gopal and Kalai. Kalivan's 08. You get poli-size DNF are learnable in some model of learning theory, which I won't take the time to describe, but it has some sort of applications to other parts of theoretical computer science. So that's one good reason to want to try to prove it. Another consequence of the conjecture, this is also very easy to show, is the KKL theorem, Kahn-Pillai and lineal. So of course, we already know this theorem is true. So I mean, it's not like we're trying to prove this so that we can prove this. But this demonstrates that somehow this conjecture is harder than proving the KKL theorem. And proving the KKL theorem already requires some non-elementary steps, so hypercontractivity at least. So it says that if you want to prove this conjecture, I mean, you'll have to do something pretty clever at least. So that's the state of affairs. Let me tell you about some results on this problem. Okay, so the conjecture was made in 96, and I guess from 96 to 2009, there was nothing. It's pretty tough, I guess. And 2010 was the first result. This was by Clivens, Lee, and Wan. And they showed that the conjecture holds for random polynomial size DNF formula. OK, so there's an appropriate model of how to choose a random polynomial size DNF formula. And they showed that almost all such formulas satisfy the conjecture. That's pretty good. And the other results, I guess, are the ones that I'll tell you about today, or mention today. So these are due to myself, Wright, and Joe. And what did we manage to prove? So as Oded alluded, we proved it for symmetric F. Okay, and by symmetric here, I mean like totally symmetric. So the function only depends on like the number of ones in the input. It's invariant under any permutation. And I guess we proved it with some constant, which, I don't know, maybe I'll tell you it's like 12 point something. And we have some like slight extensions of this as well. So if as an extension, if F is invariant under maybe not Sn, the full symmetry group, but if it's invariant under something like Sn1 cross Snd, then we get it with C equals the same constant plus log base 2 of D. So if D is a constant, then it's a constant. In particular, actually, every function is invariant under no symmetry. So with D equals n, which gives you the constant log n here, which is sort of known. It's kind of trivial to prove that this inequality holds with log n instead of c, what this sort of interpolates between the two cases. When we started working on this, I mean, I thought actually, symmetric functions is a really, really special case. I mean, it's a really small class of functions. I thought when we started working on this that it might be an interesting case, though, because I had some intuition that symmetric functions have like lots of symmetries, so the Fourier spectrum is really spread out. So the left-hand side is large, so that means you have your work cut out for you. But in the end, it wasn't so hard. So it's all the techniques are kind of elementary. So we don't introduce anything that is sort of necessary to prove the full theorem, but I'll tell you about it anyway. We also proved it by sort of different methods for a different class of functions, like read once, decision trees, and some generalizations of this. So there's some other constant, 4.8 or something. I think we can do it for read once formulas. These are all special cases. I guess one more thing I'll say is that I also know that C, at least 60 over 13, this is like 4.6 or something, is necessary. So this gets back to somebody's earlier question, who asked, what function do you think is worse or sharp for this inequality? And for a long, long time, I thought it was you know, indicators of subspaces or AND functions or functions. And if you do the calculations, then for such a function, this is 4. And you know, every other function that you can think of, like majority and trides and inner product mod 2, they all work with constant equal to 4 or less than or equal to 4. And so I thought if you know, there's any justice in the world, this should be the right constant. But I mean, I guess it's not. This is like some weird iterated version of a function on 5 variables that I found with a computer. Yeah, actually, in light of this example, like I have no particular confidence one way or the other as to whether the conjecture is true. But well, still, if there's any justice in the world, it should be true.
So you just mentioned something about subspaces, and then that triggered this question. When you're talking about if you took a fine transformation of the domain, then the left-hand side doesn't change, but the right-hand side does.
Yeah, so that's a sort of a weird aspect of this inequality, as Madhu says. If you take f and you like apply an invertible linear transformation to the domain before you apply f, then it just sort of shifts the Fourier spectrum around. So the left-hand side does not change. But the right-hand side, you know, probably does change, which is a bit odd that it's not invariant under this operation. But I don't know what else to say. Yeah, that's an odd feature of it.
What you said were for indicators of half spaces or
subspaces for AND functions in the computer science language. Right. So, yeah. So, I, for the rest of the talk, I'm just going to tell you about the proof of this fact. This proof is, as you expect, by induction, some sort of structural induction. It's a bit tricky, but not too enlightening, I guess. OK, so therefore, for the rest of the talk, I mean, it's going to just be devoted to more or less trying to prove this. And so in particular, for the rest of the talk, we're going to assume that the function f is symmetric. And we'll tackle this inequality, which is written here. So maybe I should leave it. OK, so one observation, I mean, if you have a symmetric function, a totally symmetric function, then its Fourier spectra is also totally symmetric. In other words, f hat s only depends on the cardinality of s, which makes our life a lot simpler. So it's sort of natural to sort of break things up in terms of the cardinality of s. So in particular, let's get started. So I have the thing on the left-hand side, the entropy of this script s. And I guess by basic ideas of conditional entropy, this is equal to the entropy of the random variable, which is the cardinality of S, plus the entropy of the random variable, which is S conditioned on the cardinality of S. Really, you would have the joint random variable here, S and its cardinality, but S implies its cardinality, so that's OK. OK, so we're trying to bound this by the right-hand side, which, remember also, this is the total influence. Well, a constant times the right-hand side. I'm not going to pay attention to the explicit constants here. So it's enough to try to bound each of these terms by the constant times the total influence. Well, the first term is this. So we want to show this. The entropy of the cardinality of the spectral sample is at most constant times the total influence. And this I'll skip in the interest of time. I don't have enough time to fit it in, even though it's pretty easy. So first of all, I should remark that actually this holds. This doesn't need symmetry. OK, this is true for all Boolean valued functions. And basically, it's kind of a little calculation. It only needs one trick. You need the edge isoparametric inequality for the Boolean Q. But once I tell you that you know you'll need to use this at some point and say, OK, now to go home and it's an exercise. It's not a very hard exercise. You need some arithmetic in addition to that. OK, so I'll skip that, but it's not too hard. OK, so the main part then is the other bound. So we want to bound the entropy of S conditioned on its cardinality. And right, so we want to decide. This is at most a constant times the total influence of f. And as I said, if f is symmetric, its Fourier spectrum is symmetric. So once I tell you the cardinality of S, condition on it, then the conditional distribution of S is just like the uniform distribution over n choose k, sorry, n choose cardinality things. Okay, so its entropy is just the log of that. Okay, so in other words, I'm saying what this is exactly equal to is the sum over all k going from 0 to n, representing the cardinality of the probability that the cardinality equals k times log of n choose k. OK. Now, what is this first quantity here, the probability that S, its cardinality equals k? Well, just by definition, it's the sum over all S of cardinality k, F hat S squared, which is what I call the weight at level k of F. I guess that's hopefully still up on this board here. OK, so this is something we know about. And well, now I'll just do some arithmetic to upper bound this. So this is at most the log base 2 of, I guess n choose k is at most n times e over k to the k. Okay. So let's see. I want to say that's k log e plus k log n over k. OK, I should be omitting these terms if k is 0. OK, and let me continue from here. This is just, I'll call it O of 1 times k plus, and I'd rather write ln instead of log, so I'll write this as O of 1 times k times ln of n over k. OK, so therefore, this thing I'm trying to bound here, let me say the left-hand side is at most well, O of 1 times sum over k, the weight at level k of f times k, that's this first term here, plus O of 1 times the sum over k of the weight at level k of f times k times ln n over k. OK, and this is the thing, remember, I'm trying to show it's dominated by this quantity. OK. Well, actually, this is exactly the total influence of k. Or sorry, of f. Right? I don't know if this formula is still up here. OK. Yeah, it's sort of here. It's the star. It's the same thing. So that's great. You know, it's bounded by a constant times itself, so we don't have to worry about this term. So it comes down to this term. Okay, so sorry, there's a lot of calculations in this talk. Okay, so what I'm saying is that it remains to worry about this last term. So it remains to show the following, that sum k goes from 1 to n of this thing, k, I've got a lot quieter here, k wk of f ln n over k is at most a constant times sum over k times, sorry, k times wk of f. OK? This is also the total influence. OK, so that's just some, I don't know, all the obvious steps that you would do, and you get to sort of this point.
You didn't use symmetry.
I did use symmetry here.
Oh, yeah, right.
Okay, so we kind of, without loss of generality, this is what you have to prove. And after you look at it for a second, it looks sort of, at least to me, it looks sort of blatantly false. Because, I mean, the sums kind of look the same, right? You have this k times the weight at level k here.
It seems that if you can prove this inequality without symmetry, then you are done from the entire conjecture, because
Entropy is always bounded by this.
Yes. But I think probably it's not hard to show that this is false for general functions.
Yes, I guess, but so the answer for what Avi says is that actually I did not use symmetry because
yes.
this would hold without symmetry, it will be enough.
Yeah, you're actually right, Nathan. In some sense, I didn't use symmetry here. I will, in showing that this is true. Good, that's a good point. Okay, so as I was saying, it looks kind of blatantly false because, I mean, at least up until like K gets, you know, linearly comparable to n, like you have like an extra ln n term here, right? So it looks like somehow this is going to be possible. But, well, it's possible. I mean, I'll show it to you when f is symmetric. So I guess it just means you can't do it term by term. Okay, so as I was saying, you know, we did some sort of obvious calculations. And then if it could be said that there's any idea in the proof I'm showing you, it comes at this point. So what is the idea? It's an idea. Well, I mean, we were thinking about this thing, and we know that it implies KKL. So somehow, one natural idea is to, you know, try and use the same proof idea as the idea in KKL. So what's the idea of KKL? Well, the way I think about KKL is that you somehow show that the derivatives of your function f, dIf, are very noise sensitive. I'll make this formal later. Okay. So you somehow deduce an inequality about the noise sensitivity of these derivative functions, and then you sum these inequalities over I. So if I had to give, you know, a two sentence summary of KKL's proof, it would be this, and this will actually be the same idea in our case. Okay, so all right, if we're going to follow this idea, we need to look at the derivatives of f, where f is a symmetric function. Okay, this is the definition of derivatives, so we can all remember it before I erase it. So if you have a symmetric function and you look at a derivative, in some sense it doesn't matter which of the n coordinates you take the derivative with respect to, in the sense that if you look at the derivative as just a function of n minus 1 bits, then it's sort of the same function whichever derivative you take. But still, it will actually be convenient for us to think of it as a function of all n bits, and so each derivative has one irrelevant coordinate which is different for the different derivatives. We need to prove this key inequality. Let me call it star. And we want to do it by looking at derivatives, so let's understand, let's say, the weights.
You already have
star. Uh-oh. Do I? Oh, luckily I can erase that. No, because I need to. Maybe I'll need double star later. And triple star just can't be done. Okay, so we need to understand the relationship between f's weights and its derivative. So let's see. So let's say you have some function f. And I'm going to write down its Fourier expansion. So it's got some terms. And maybe now I'll look at the degree 3 part. Okay, so the first term is on x1, x2, x3. And maybe it has some coefficient alpha, right? But if f is totally symmetric, then it has the same coefficient for all degree 3 terms, right? So you get plus alpha times x1, x2, x4, plus, maybe up to alpha x1, xn minus 1, xn, plus maybe then alpha x2, x3, x4, alpha xn minus 2, n minus 1, xn, and there's some non-degree 3 terms. But this is what it'll look like. And what goes on with the derivative? So let's say I look at g, which is the derivative with respect to the first coordinate. Okay, so it's just like you take the derivative, right? So every term that involves x1 stays alive, and the other ones die, and you have to erase x1. So we get alpha x2, x3, plus alpha x2, x4, plus alpha xn minus 1, xn, and then these terms all die. Okay, so let's see. So If this is the case, then the weight at level 3 of F is alpha squared times n choose 3. Right? And the weight at level 2 of F, sorry, of G, is somehow related. It's alpha squared times n minus 1 choose 2. OK, so you see that, therefore, just by rearranging the weight at level 2 of G is 3 over n times the weight at level 3 of F. Right? Because basically, you keep around the triplets that contain x1. And what's the probability that a triplet contains x1? It's 3 over n. OK, so therefore, this also implies the weight at level k of G is k over n times the weight at level, sorry, minus 1, the weight at level k of f. That's a proof by example. OK, so let me just move this n here over here. This is n, and this is k. OK, so you see that this quantity, k times the weight at level k, which appears a couple of times in star, it's simplified a bit here. It's also the weight at level k minus 1 of g. OK, so that's nice. We'll substitute that in. It'll make our formulas a bit simpler. OK, so I'll do that now. I'll warn you also that I'm afraid now I have to do like a bit more arithmetic and mess around with formulas, so bear with me. OK, so you see I'm going to plug this into what's now star. And I guess I'll get a factor of n on both sides, but I'll just cancel that. Right? So what I'm saying is that star is equivalent to, let's see, I guess, right, sum k goes from 1 to n. The weight at level k of, sorry, minus 1 of g less than or equal to maybe question mark, because it's what we're trying to prove. Oh, sorry, I dropped a term here. Ln n over k less than or equal to constant times the sum k goes from 1 to n of the weight at level k minus 1 of g. Did I do that correctly?
You keep the g or you want to look at di?
Yeah, it doesn't matter which one you choose here. So this is true for any derivative that these are equivalent.
Now you're going to, I mean, so g is a derivative of a Boolean function, symmetric.
Yeah, so this is the thing, that's somewhat weird thing you have to remember. Like, what's the condition we have on g? The condition is that it's the derivative of a symmetric function. OK? We'll definitely use that. This is, I mean, this k minus 1 is slightly annoying, so I'm just going to change it to an L. I'll set L equals k minus 1, so let's see. This is L. This is k plus 1? L plus 1, yeah. L plus 1. This is L. Now L is going from 0 to n minus 1. And L is going from 0 to n minus 1. OK, hopefully that's OK. Pardon me? We have this n? Yeah, it appears on both sides in the right hand in the star, so I just divided through by it. Okay. Oh, and so by the way, this is also, I mean, this is the sum, you know, this is the Fourier weight at level L, but I'm just summing it up over all L. So it's just the sum of the squares of all the Fourier coefficients, which by Parseval is the same as the expected square of g. So I'll write that now. I'll write the expected square of g here. And of course, remember that since f is minus 1, 1 valued and g is the derivative, it's minus 1, 0, 1 valued. OK. Maybe I should call this. Oh, I can still call it star. OK. So yeah. So we use this idea. Now we have to leave the realm of ideas and get into the annoying realm of just manipulation. So we'll do that for a while and then come back to some more abstract stuff. So what would we do with this? Well, we have a lawn, so we'll just use a trick. This is basically equal to the sum over L, W, L of G. And now for this lawn of N over L plus 1, I'd like to write the sum is J, let me get the indices right, equals L plus 1 to the N of 1 over J. Okay. And actually, if you like pay a little bit of attention, it's extremely boring. This is actually literally true with less than or equal to here. Okay. So again, you know, whenever we have a double sum, we should reverse it. So this is equal to the sum over J and also over L. I'll get to the condition in a second, so I'll move the 1 over J in. And wait, what am I doing here? Yeah, the weight at level L of G. And then I have this condition that J is bigger than L. Right, that's the same thing, I hope. Okay, so let me do some stuff. You all know that's such a like weird step function, like the indicator that J is bigger than L is kind of annoying. So let's replace it by something that looks a bit nicer analytically. So this is the indicator that, well, let me call it L is less than J. Yeah, so basically this is something like 1 minus 1 over J to the L. I want to say at most this. That's not quite right. I guess if L is really big, then this is 0, so that's okay because this is not negative. The worst is if L is like right around J. This is supposed to be 1. This is only something like 1 over E. But I mean, it's true if I put E here. Okay, so simple fact. And I don't really care about constants, so I'll plug this in here. And we get that this is at most, well, E, I'll just write it as O of 1. Times sum j goes from 1 to n of 1 over j times sum over L weighted level L of g times 1 minus 1 over j to the L. Okay, sorry about all the manipulations here. But now if you know your Fourier stuff, this should look familiar. You'd sum up all the weights of function g according to the level, but you attenuate it by this factor, some number to the power of L. Okay. So this is exactly the noise stability of g at this parameter. We get sum j goes from 1 to n, 1 over j, times the noise stability, I'll say what this is in a second, at 1 minus 1 over j of g. So so this is something that has a combinatorial or probabilistic interpretation. And by a simple calculation, it also has this formula. Perhaps you've seen it before. In any case, I'll tell you the meaning of this noise stability of G, or of any function. OK, so recall. The noise stability, let's say at 1 minus epsilon of a function j, any real valued function, is just defined to be the expected value of h of x times h of y. Or these are random strings, but they're not independent. They're chosen in a correlated way. The experiment is that x is uniform. Okay, and then y is formed by, you take x and you flip each coordinate with probability epsilon over 2. Okay, so they're somehow correlated random strings. You pick a random string x, then you flip each coordinate with probability epsilon over 2, and that's y. Okay, and then you can ask about sort of the correlation between h of x and h of y. And well, it's an easy exercise to show that you can express that with a formula like this in terms of the Fourier coefficients. Okay, so this is sort of my favorite, or maybe the best bridge between the world of Fourier coefficients and the world of just the original physical space of combinatorics and probability. Okay. So we're you know, getting towards our destination here. So I told you this was the idea, that we want to show that the derivatives di f are very noise sensitive, using, of course, that f is a symmetric function. And in other words, we want to show that this noise stability for g is small. Okay, so this is maybe the main theorem, I guess. Let's say let g be a function, you know, from into minus 1, 0, 1, be the or a derivative of a symmetric function. Okay, then it's very noise sensitive. So then, for all epsilon less than 1, I don't know, less than or equal to, the noise stability at 1 minus epsilon of g is at most constant, basically, but the constant times a 1 over root epsilon n times the expected value of g squared. OK, and there's some constant here, which is actually small. It's 2 over root pi, but it doesn't really matter. OK, so the way to think about this is that you know, it's saying that the function is really noise sensitive. So remember, this g, the stability is the sum of the Fourier coefficients squared, but attenuated by this factor, whereas the right-hand side is just the sum of all the Fourier coefficients squared. So this is saying that even if the noise is like very small, like this is much less than sort of its theoretical maximum, right? Even if like epsilon, think of epsilon as like 100 over n, then you know 1 over root epsilon n is like, I guess it's 1/10. So it's somehow like noticeably smaller than, you know, what it could possibly be, even for like very, very small noise rates. Okay. So that's the key theorem. We need to execute this idea.
So it's, in the theorem, it's a derivative of a symmetric Boolean function.
Yeah, yeah, a minus 1, 1 symmetric function, valued function. And let's just finish the proof of everything assuming this theorem. It's like one line.
Symmetric would really mean very close to majority, right? Because otherwise, you're somehow using somewhere that the expectation is around 100.
No, this is any symmetric function. It could be and, for example.
But is the conjecture much easier if the, you know, if the symmetric function has a, you know, has probability 1 only? As one only with
no, it's sort of actually equally interesting. Yes. I mean, it really. But for example, for a while I thought that the worst example was the AND function. And actually, there's a reduction from the general case, not even symmetry or anything. There's a reduction from the general case to the case where the function's total influence is linear. So. If you want to sort of assume that the function has like a decent variance, you can. Okay, so I'll just finish the proof. It's like one line here. So where are we here? Okay, we have this thing, star. Okay, the left-hand side of star is this thing. We want to bound it by the right-hand side. So of course, we just plug in this theorem with epsilon equal to 1 over j. And I guess we got that this thing here is at most, well, a constant standing in for this root 2 over pi and the other constant, sum j goes from 1 to n of 1 over j. Now, if epsilon is 1 over j, then I guess this 1 over root epsilon n factor, where did it go? It's up there. It becomes 1 over root n over j times the expected value of g squared. OK, so this is, I'll pull out all the constant factors. I get O of 1, expected value of g squared, 1 over root n, and then sum j goes from 1 to n. If I get the root j on top, 1 over root j. OK, but the sum is is like root n. Okay, so this cancels with this, and you get the right-hand side you want. Sorry? No, because the j is it's in a fraction here. Okay, so again, manipulation. Right, so now we can kind of forget all these manipulations, and it comes down to proving this theorem, which has nothing to do with Fourier. I mean, it's just it's a probabilistic theorem, and it's kind of elementary. Well, it is elementary. So I have enough time to more or less show you the proof. Maybe I'll skip a little bit at the end. We'll see how it goes. Okay, so just to remind you about this theorem, we have a symmetric Boolean function f, and then we have its derivative. So let me draw you a picture. So this is the theorem's proof. Okay, so remember, it's symmetric, so it only depends on the Hamming weights of its input f. So the Hamming weights go from, 0 up to maybe n plus 1. Let's just say for convenience, this is a picture of f. You know, it takes on values that are plus or minus 1. So, maybe here it's plus 1, maybe it's minus 1, maybe it's plus 1, minus 1, minus 1, plus 1. I have a reason to actually draw these out. Okay, but that's f. Okay, and the function g, I said you should think of it as a function on sort of all the bits, but now I don't want to do that anymore. I want to think of it as a function just on n bits. So now it's also a symmetric function. It's minus 1, 0, 1 values, right? And it's the derivative of this function. So if you just look at the formula, you see what's its value sort of here. You just take the value that's 1 up and subtract the value that's 1 down and divide by 2. So from here, you're going from plus 1 to minus 1. So that's you go down by minus 1. Here you go from minus 1 to minus 1. So you get 0. Then you go up, so it's 1. Then you go from 1 to 1, so it's 0. You go back down, so it's minus 1. And here it's up. Here it's down, et cetera. People understand what I'm drawing with this diagram? Okay, so good. So g is a symmetric function. It's minus 1, 0, 1 valued. But that's not the only thing it is. I mean, it's also, by virtue of it being the derivative of a symmetric function, there's one more fact that you have about it. Does anybody see what that is? Yeah, I think you're all saying it. The key is that if you ignore the zeros, then the plus and minus ones alternate or interleave. All right, because what goes up must come down. So if you go up, then you can go 0 for a while, but then you have to go back down again. Okay, and this will be the only thing we need to prove this theorem about noise sensitivity. You can kind of maybe already see it, right? Because somehow, in this definition of noise sensitivity, you choose x that gets you somewhere. But somehow, if that's, let's say, plus, then the nearby points are negative. So somehow it can has a greater chance to cancel things out. That was not a very clear explanation. But anyway, I'll just do the proof. So the stability at 1 minus epsilon of g is the expected value of g of x, g of y, when x and y are chosen from this experiment, which I'll write as the expected value over x of g of x times the expected value over y of g of y. Okay, and now I'll make the following claim. Actually, for all x, it doesn't matter what x is. If you look at the expected value of g of y, where sort of y is drawn condition on x, so y is some epsilon over 2 noisy version of x. If you look at this in absolute value, The absolute value is at most O of 1 over root epsilon n. Okay. So I'll prove this claim in a second. But you see, once we have this claim, then again, we're done. Because, look, you draw x. It has some value that's either plus or minus 1 or 0. And then the remaining quantity in absolute value is at most this number. So I mean, we just immediately conclude that this thing is at most the expected value over x of, well, the absolute value of g of x times O of 1 over epsilon n root. I guess I can just put the brackets here. But g's values are minus 1, 0, and 1. So the absolute value is the same as the square. So this is the same as the expected value of g squared. OK, and that's what we were trying to prove. OK, so one last step is to verify this claim. OK, so proof of claim. OK, so say you fix x, and say that the Hamming weight of x, I'll write the Hamming weight as bars of x, is s. Great. So in this picture, you know, you chose x uniformly at random. Maybe it was like here. And this is the point s. So x has Hamming weight s. And now y is formed by like flipping each bit of s x with probability epsilon over 2. So you know, you go to some different Hamming weight. Maybe the shape of the distribution looks like this. OK. So let's write p sub t, or the probability when y is this noisy version of x, that the Hamming weight of y equals t. OK, well, what can we say about this probability? Well, what is the distribution of the Hamming weight of y? Well, we know that x has s, let's say, 1s in it. And they stay 1s with probability 1 minus epsilon over 2. So from those, you get a contribution that's a binomial random variable, parameters s and 1 minus epsilon over 2. Remaining guys in x, of which they're n minus s, are zeros, and they become ones with minus ones, and they become ones with probability epsilon over 2. Okay, so this is the exact distribution of y. These are independent binomials. Actually, if you have any sum of independent Bernoulli random variables, it's a simple fact that that distribution is unimodal. It's a very easy exercise. So what I'm saying is that, therefore, the sequence of PTs is unimodal, i.e., it's increasing for a while and then decreasing for a while. You know, I mean, Bernoullis have this, binomials have this property, and same with sum of independent binomials or Bernoullis. Okay, so this is the key claim that. Yeah, this is the claim. Better not erase this. Okay. So we're looking at the, let's say, the expectation over y of g of y. Well, actually, an absolute value. So I mean, we just have these p sub t's, and we know it has this interleaving property, right? So it looks like maybe, I don't know, maybe the first few are 0, and then maybe it's like plus p3 minus p4 plus p6 minus p8 plus p10 minus p20, something like this, right? So an absolute value, it's this. And An extremely simple exercise is just that this is bounded by the maximum value of the piece. So this is extremely simple. This is at most the max over t of the pt's. OK, and then you have a calculation. I mean, you have a binomial random variable. And you're looking at like the maximum probability it takes for any one atom. Basically, the worst case is when it's n over 2, n over 2. So it's like the max pmf of like, you know, even a binomial n over 2, epsilon over 2.
And that easy path is where you use the unimodality. Right?
Yeah, yeah, this is the unimodality. OK, and this is just a fact. It's 1 over the standard deviation, which is this. OK, so I went a little fast at the end here, but that's the gist of this claim and the proof of everything. So I'll stop here.
Questions? So do you have a sense that, so these other things that you proved, did you repeat any of the ingredients? So if there's any sort of takeaway claims from this part of the proof.
Which part of the proof?
From the proof that you gave us. So there are these other things like the Riedmann's decision trees and so on.
Oh, yeah. No, this is totally different. This is a proof by just the induction on the form of the decision tree. And for the more general versions of this, like Riedmann's formulas, it's one of those tricky things where you have like an induction, but you actually have to strengthen, so like insert a term into the induction in order that you can prove it by induction. So most of the trick is like finding that unexpected term.
And does noise stability come up in the KKL proof?
Yeah, you can think of it as like looking at sort of the noisy influences of the function. If a function has like small mean, and its sort of noisy influences are really small, and then you add that fact up over all the derivatives.
So can you strengthen the conjecture to the noise to make it the sum over the noise sensitivity of the derivatives? On the
I don't think so. For example, this thing that we proved about the noise sensitivity of the derivative of a symmetric function, it's also definitely false if it's just a symmetric function. Well, because they're very noise stable symmetric functions, like majority. So I'm not sure how you would think to strengthen the conjecture.
So you start with a function that is Boolean.
Yeah.
But to formulate the conjecture, you only need this function to have second moment 1, right?
No, I mean, the conjecture is definitely false if you only have second moment 1.
That was the question. What is the example to
start? Let's say f of x is sum I goes from 1 to n of 1 over root n times xi. So it says sum of squares of coefficients equal to 1. The total influence is 1 because all the concentration is on, well, you just have like the spectral sample S is uniform over a set of size n. So the entropy is log n, but the expected cardinality is 1.
Really need some structural.
Yeah, so another way you can think of the conjecture is saying that like there's no Boolean function that looks like this, Boolean valued function that looks like this, even for like higher degrees. Like, I don't know, there's like no function that looks like this of degree, I don't know, poly log n. Keith?
What is the relationship between this and the Talleyrand theorem, which involves this
log n of poly? Yeah, so the Talleyrand theorem is like a strengthening of KKL. It's not too much stronger, but it's a bit formally stronger. I'm not completely certain if the entropy influence directly implies Talleyrand. I'd have to think about it. But morally, it seems harder, because morally, KKL and the Talleyrand inequality are not too far apart.
What really makes you think this one is true?
That's what I said. Actually, I don't even know. So maybe we should ask Hüding Gill.
We have a very limited imagination, so our arsenal of examples all...
You try like every example you think of, it seems to be true. Like, syntactically, it uses like, a lot of the same letters as like the log sub 11 inequality, so... The inequality goes the other way.
Maybe we should state it with four.
Pardon me?
Maybe we should have stated.
Yeah, and then I could, you know, give you a counterexample involving a function on 30 indices. Yeah, Nathan?
Yes, Ryan mentioned now that in some sense the conjecture says that there does not exist a Boolean function of such form, say it is uniform on the only on the K3 level. So in this formulation, it can be proved that that there indeed does not exist such function. There is some easy result which recently that if the function does not have Fourier weight at all beyond some level, then approximately the conjecture holds. And there is a stronger result of Gill and Schoenberg gain, which does not appear here, although it is 10 years old because it was never published, that if the Fourier coefficients decay exponentially over some beyond some level, then also approximately the conjecture holds. So it's a nice result, and it even uses a bit heavier tools such like the Bechner inequality, but it was never published.
Yeah. Actually, there are functions that like are totally concentrated on some level, like, I don't know, n to a power, but they're not spread everywhere. I mean, they're only supported on an amount that's not maximal. So you again do the calculation, and it's okay. You don't get an extra log factor. Any more questions?
Thanks, Ryan.